Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber.
This episode of Red Inca, we talk about OCD and how it changed the career of Australian ODI player Wes Agar. To do that, we got on someone who'd had a very long chat with him.
My name's Ildiko Connell, and I'm one of the girls behind Daisy Cutter Cricket Fanzine, which is a blog / Twitter account / Instagram account / whatever we want it to be.
We talk about OCD, anorexia, mental compulsions, TED Talks, exposure therapy, leaving behind a contract, and sleeping on the floor.
My first question is, how did you first hear about Wes Agar? Because to be fair, I think the vast majority of people who follow cricket are not Wes Agar enthusiasts. They don't know a lot about Wes Agar. He's not a very famous cricketer.
Honestly, I was just interested in the topic of like OCD and cricket, and so I just googled it and his name came up. So
you learn about him through that. That is a fast. I was expecting it to be like something random, like you started playing a game once and you got interested. It's like, no,
I didn't know he existed, like, yeah, from watching the big bash and stuff, but yeah, that's kind of how it came about.
Well, you've already mentioned OCD, so I'm not very good at this stuff. What is OCD?
So OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. It's a mental health condition. It tends to be a lifelong mental health condition. And it also kind of comes under the umbrella of neurodivergent conditions. So there's a lot of overlap with things like ADHD and autism. If you were to do a Venn diagram, there's quite a big bit in the middle. And it kind of consists of obsessions and then compulsions. And I think a lot of people can relate to it in a lot of ways, because a lot of the things that it might start with might be quite normal anxieties, but the way that it develops is that your kind of fight or flight response is activated to things that aren't real threats. So that might be thoughts and anxieties. And then people develop compulsions to try and alleviate that anxiety and deal with the issue. And then you sort of get trapped in a loop of it because it's not a real threat. It's also not a real solution. So that's where it can sort of start taking over people's lives, and that's where it becomes the disorder part rather than just, say, having a few quirks or a few anxieties.
Yeah. And you wrote in the piece that estimated 2% of the population has it. So if that's the case, we would assume that 2% of cricketers have that. We're just sort of getting to autism and ADHD and other things that are affecting cricketers over the last couple of years. So OCD is certainly something that comes up a lot. But generally, when we talk about it in cricket, we talk about it in the sort of comical way, right? Like Neil McKenzie and the you know, toilet seats, and Neil McKenzie and the bat being stuck to the ceiling, and, you know, all those sorts of things. It's not often talked about from a mental health point of view.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the maybe misconceptions that people have about it. It gets very confused with things like superstitions or habits. And the sort of difference there is, if someone feels like they've got to wear a certain pair of socks when they play because it's their lucky pair of socks or something, that's sort of more of a superstition. And when it might cross over into something like OCD is if they felt like they absolutely couldn't play if they didn't have that pair of socks, and they just couldn't do it because that is then a problem for them. So you do hear a lot of little superstitions and quirks in cricket, and I think sometimes it gets mislabeled with something like OCD because people don't really understand what's actually going on there. But I also think that sometimes there probably is an element of that, but because people don't really speak about it very much, it's hard to tell the difference, or you don't really know how to differentiate between one or the other.
Now, it's an interesting one in cricket as well. I know quite a few cricketers who've been diagnosed either right at the end of their career with something or just after they retire. And quite often, and this, I think this will make you laugh, but quite often it's when the men go back to the house and they're with their wife and family quite a bit. And the wife and family is like, this, what you're doing is not a normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think it was Mitchell Johnson's wife who said that the way he played with the remote control, she was like, I think he did like a pattern that he would just repeat over and over again. She's like, that's not a normal thing for a person to do. And so when they're playing, they're just quirky and it's just part of the banter, right? And it's everything else. And so, you know, there have been players like, I think maybe most famously is Benny Howe and his ADHD. He was largely tested because it was actually affecting his career. Whereas if it's not affecting your career, you kind of just go on with it and you're the fun guy in the corner who does the weird things.
Yeah, and I think also if you're experiencing something like that and it is quite hard to open up about, or maybe you don't even understand it yourself properly, it's easier to go with the angle of I'm going to laugh it off a bit and make it more of a comical thing, and sort of lean into it that way, because if you get super serious about it, you might end up in a position where that's even more awkward or uncomfortable for you.
And how did you learn about OCD?
Well, I have OCD, so.
Okay, that's easier.
Yeah, so I got diagnosed with OCD in 2020, just before the pandemic lockdown, so that was really unhelpful for me. They basically just were like, here you go, and we're all getting redeployed to something else to do with COVID, so see you later.
We'll see you in 4 years.
But I kind of knew already that I had it because I was aware of what I was doing and what the kind of symptoms were. And I think about 2011, I was in a state where it took me like 2 hours to leave my house because every time I left my house, I'd have to go back and check that the door was locked, like over and over again, which obviously is not rational at all, because if you go and check it once and it's locked, it's not going to have magically become unlocked the second time, the third time you come back. But I just got stuck in that. So I knew that's what it was, but to actually get it formally diagnosed, you have to go through quite a long process. You've got to get referred to a psychiatrist. So you can kind of see a therapist and come up with strategies to deal with it and things like that. So you already sort of know. And sort of from there, I'd kind of got a bit better. And then during the pandemic, it got worse again, which I think is probably true for a lot of people. I think it probably, maybe some people who had that kind of tendency, it probably aggravated into a full-blown kind of OCD thing, because the situation we were all in then was like quite scary, but also the ways that we were being told to cope with it were quite extreme. You know, all the hand washing, all the staying away from people, the kind of messaging that, you know, if you go outside, you're going to end up killing someone's granny because you breathe on them. Like, that feeds in very easily to people who have OCD or maybe OCD traits already. So yeah, that's how I know about it from having it.
And the whole thing's so fascinating. Also, like when you said before about the 2% who have it, if it's very hard to diagnose, that probably means that it's a much higher percentage that have it, right? And we just don't get
almost
the number.
Certainly. Yeah. And I think also I read something that said if you then want to expand that out to people whose lives are affected by it, you're probably going up to like 4 or 5% because you're including people whose loved ones have it or friend, you know, the friends have it, family have it, and they're supporting them. So it does spread out wider than that.
One thing that, and I don't know a lot about OCD, but one thing I was absolutely fascinated in is its relationship to anorexia, which I did not see coming.
Yeah, it's something that I thought about before, but not maybe as in depth. And I definitely struggled with my eating when I was younger. And it's a lot of the time with this kind of thing, it's only when you look back on it, you go, oh, I'm connecting the dots now. This is actually makes more sense to me. And I think with disordered eating, there's sort of different reasons people might end up in that situation. It might not be related to OCD, but it might be. And if you kind of try and find out which way someone's come into it, it's going to help them deal with it. So I think it's quite an important link to make, actually. I've known other people who didn't want to eat because they were so scared of throwing up, as was in the article. So it is like a thing that happens to people.
And you know, it's another fascinating thing of like, I know players who have been opened up about certain things in their life, but they actually have far darker things or far, you know, other things within that. It's interesting that Wes Agar was willing to talk about all of this, right? Like there's very much I wouldn't say he's using the media or anything to come clean about it, but he's kind of trying to show everyone as much as he can information to let people understand what this is.
Yeah, I was like really pleasantly surprised actually by how open he was willing to be, because you don't know when you approach someone and they say yes to it, you know, how much they're actually going to tell you. And he previously mentioned it on a podcast a few years ago, but it was sort of in passing. And you can hear on the podcast, he didn't really sound particularly like keen to talk about it, but obviously wants to because he wants people to know about it. So there's obviously a bit of a tension there. And then when it came to having this discussion, as he says in the article, like he felt ready to talk about it and wanted people to know more about it so that people could understand better. I was kind of taken aback by how open he was, but in a really, really good way, because it's quite a misunderstood condition and it also affects people in a really individual way. It's not that general. So it's actually really important for people to be able to go into the actual detail of individual kind of obsessions or compulsions that they might have, so that you can actually read it or listen to it and understand sort of the A to B to C to D that's going on there.
No, definitely. And also, like, as a reporter, sometimes you know that a person has the issue, but when you contact them, they don't want to be seen as just the player with the issue, right? And so, you know, as you said, he'd mentioned it briefly on a podcast. I think that's a Cricket Australia podcast, or is it the other one? I can't remember. It's one of the Australian podcasts anyway that he mentioned it on. And, you know, he's maybe in a more of a safe space, whereas now he's allowing some freaky outsider to come in who, and you know, and I've been this freaky outsider many times before, whereas you are coming to it from a point of view of, I have a chance to explain to people about OCD and, you know, how it might affect cricketers and how it might affect people in their normal life and everything. And he's like, yeah, but I don't want to be your, you know, guinea pig here. So it's great that he went the other way with it and was like, okay, we're going to do this. Because it's a really long article. Like, it's quite in depth. So he obviously talked to you for some time.
Yeah. And I think it is a long article, but I sort of think it needed to be because it's sort of going along all the stops on the journey that he's had. So you can't really cut any of them out because then you're sort of losing the thread of what was actually happening.
No, I mean, it should. I wasn't saying that as if to say you'd overwritten it. I just meant that, like, you know, I've seen this article before where it's 600 words and the player says, yes, I have OCD. Yes, I'm taking, you know, medication or, you know, getting mental health help with it. And then the person just has to fill in the 600 words. That wasn't the case with you, right? You were writing around he said, but he gave you so much as well.
Yeah, I was really glad for that because I think it's kind of a pitfall of trying to write about mental health related topics, really, is that people want to talk about it, but they only want to talk about it to a certain extent and they'll still hold back. And then you end up with something that it's helpful, but it's a bit sanitized or it's a bit oversimplified. Yeah. And it's like often a frustration that I've had with reading them because I'm like, okay, but I want to know more. Like, how is this actually relevant? What's actually going on? And it also, the more detail you have, the easier it is for people to read it or look at it and think that's something that I can relate to.
So let's just go back to the start. So Wes Agard did have eating disorder issues himself, right? Like that was part of early on?
Yeah, well, one of the things he told me about was eating issues. I don't think it was ever diagnosed as, say, an eating disorder or anything like that. So I don't want to put those words in his mouth, but it's definitely an issue with food. And that was how it started for him.
Yeah. And then from that, you sort of have he calls them mental compulsions. Can you take me through, like, I think you kind of explained them before, but explain exactly what a mental compulsion is.
Yeah. So like a physical compulsion is something like I was saying before about checking that your door's locked. It's something that you're actually actively doing in person physically. And then a mental compulsion will be a lot more in your head. So it might be some people might be praying because they've got a religious compulsion, or they might be counting certain numbers in their heads or associating a certain thought with a certain action. There's something called thought neutralization. That's a term that comes up quite a lot. And that's basically when you have an intrusive thought that's really horrible, and then you try and think of something that will cancel it out in a way. Yeah. So you're like, oh, now I've got to think about something that's the complete opposite of this to try and neutralize it in your brain. And I mean, there's loads of different stuff, really. And it can just be checking as well. People go over their memories to try and check what happened, which is really difficult because our memories aren't perfect. Mm. And so you might be going back over a memory, but the more you go back over it, trying to check if you said something bad or if something bad happened or if you did something wrong, you can almost imagine that you did. So you can sort of trap yourself in a loop that way as well. But I think it's important to mention because it's that unseen part of the disorder, where, you know, if someone's washing their hands 50 times after doing anything, you can see that, you know, there's something up because you can see it. If it's in their head, you're not really able to see it. And it's also much harder to articulate. So to have someone elucidate that a bit more for themselves is really helpful, I think.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. And so obviously he had mental compulsions, but he also had physical compulsions. And just to explain Wes Agard, for those who don't know, obviously he's played a couple of games for Australia. He's Ashton Agar's brother. They are both Melbourne boys who couldn't quite make it in Victorian cricket when they were younger. And so they both actually moved around quite a bit. So one went to South Australia, one went to Western Australia. So he's straight away, he's quite a young professional athlete away from his family, which is already, you know, a strain on anyone there. And when he's in Adelaide, that seems to be when it goes to a different level and he really starts to struggle with it on a day-by-day basis.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. And it became quite tied into his success playing cricket. I think one of the core fears that he was articulating there was losing his cricket, losing his contract, not being a success that I think that he wanted to do. And so that's what was kind of generating the compulsive behaviours. And I know that one of the things that he said was that eventually he could not get into bed because when he was getting into bed, he was having these unpleasant intrusive thoughts that were stressing him out. And then he wanted to do something to try and get rid of them. But he started associating getting into bed with that happening to the point that then he just couldn't get into bed. So he was sleeping on the floor and then he was tired. And then when you get more tired, all of these things intensify anyway. But yeah, you can see how the pressure of going into that situation, especially as quite a young person, and then not understanding what's going on with you as well is a big part of it, because you don't know much about it and you kind of go, what's actually happening in my head? Are other people thinking like this? They don't seem to be. But then sometimes when you try and articulate it, because a lot of these things are based on what start off as rational concerns or rational worries, like it's not irrational to be worried about losing your contract and a job that you really want to do. I think sometimes if you try to explain that, people just don't understand because it's hard to articulate the part that's actually the disorder part. And also a lot of people have little quirks or superstitions sometimes. So you might say to someone, if I said, oh, I got really obsessed with checking that my door was locked. Sometimes people go, oh yeah, I'm a bit like that. I get worried I haven't locked the door. And you're like, yeah, okay. But have you gone back 25 times and been 2 hours late to work because of it? Probably not. But it's hard to say that because you don't know what people's response is going to be. And a lot of the time it probably is going to be quite negative.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Also, just from a fast bowler's point of view, it's not ideal to sleep on the floor anyway. Like, just from like, if you had to sleep on a floor, it's not going to help your performance, I would have thought, especially with backs and hamstrings. And I haven't slept on the floor enough to test this out. I don't bowl fast enough to test this out, but I would just think a bed is a better option. So not only is he getting tired and getting frustrated and obviously not understanding what's happening with his mental health, he's physically just not the same as he should be. Like he wouldn't be able to sleep off the aches and pains of which, you know, if you're a fast bowler, every single day you're sore, right? Like that is the job. Yeah. You are just sore every single day. If you're sleeping on the floor, I can only imagine that's worse.
Yeah, I'd have to assume so.
So he then decides, and this is a really interesting part, and it, you know, especially for someone who's within the sort of professional cricket structure, and I've talked to other players about this before, one of the hardest things to do is just to leave a contract behind. And that's what he does. He leaves South Australia and he leaves the contract behind. And so now you have a situation where he no longer has financial backing. I'm sure he might have been paid to play club cricket or to coach and to do some other things. But he's leaving behind his main salary at that point. But he's also, while he's doing that, so he's got to find a job and try and save his own or save his original career. But he's also now going to treat himself because he now realizes there is something actually wrong.
Yeah. And I actually thought that was really interesting because if you think about that, one of the core fears that he was articulating was losing his contract and then he goes home without a contract, that things actually happen now. And sometimes that's not the worst thing when you've got OCD because it places your fear into a more rational area because that thing's happened, but it wasn't the end of the world.
Yeah.
And so I thought that possibly might have actually been helpful in then going and dealing with it a little bit better. That's my perspective on it anyway. And it's not always true because sometimes the things that are intrusive thoughts or fears are really, really horrible. And so if they did happen, it would be the end of the world. But some of them, once they get rooted in reality and you can see that there is actually a route to dealing with it, that means it's not the worst thing that could ever happen and it's not as bad as you feared, that can actually help you sort of rewire some of those neural pathways into seeing it at the actual level of threat that it is. Because when I was saying about your fight or flight response with OCD, it's like your reaction to an intrusive thought is the same as if you were standing in front of like a lion and it was about to go for you. There's no differentiation in your brain between what's an actual real bad threat and the thoughts that you're having. So your response is the same, your nervous system response is the same. And so occasionally actually that happening and going through that process and seeing that it wasn't the same can help you calm that down.
No, it's that whole thing's really fascinating. The next bit, though, I find really, really interesting, because he goes off to get help with this medically and talks to a psychologist and everything, but it doesn't really work for him, right?
Yeah, so basically I've had the same experience with, say, counsellors and psychologists before, where they don't have the most in-depth understanding of OCD. It's more generalised. And those misconceptions that people have about it can stretch into the medical field as well. I remember getting referred to someone once for CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, which is a really common treatment for OCD. But she had like no awareness of mental compulsions. And so I just couldn't work with her because she didn't know what they were. She didn't really believe in them. I'm not really sure what was going on, but then that becomes unhelpful. And it can be quite hard to find someone who actually is quite a specialist in that area, because most of the time, if you're in, I mean, definitely in England on the NHS, if you're in the sort of mental health referral stream, it will be more generalised. It will be people who've got a broader skill set rather than specialising so much.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating as well, like, because in my head, like, I'm reading the article and I'm like, okay, and then Cricket Australia or, you know, someone in Cricket Victoria, someone finds him a doctor and it'll, but that's not what happens. In fact, and he's probably dating himself a little bit here, he goes and finds TED Talks and has a look at those. Like, that's an interesting way, and he kind of educates himself on what he has and how he can fix it.
Yeah, it was TED Talks, I think, university lectures as well. There's quite a lot of stuff out there, and you have to do a bit of filtering because it's not, some things aren't as good as others. But I mean, as another example for myself, there's a therapist called Allegra Castens, I want to say. She's on Instagram. And, you know, you might go like, oh, Instagram therapist, like, what's that going to be? Maybe not the best. But she is a OCD specialist. She has OCD. And puts a lot of content up there that's super, super informative about how it works and about all the different ways that it can present. And so I know that I found like seeing that and going through it has helped me understand it a lot better too. So there's lots of sources you can go to. And sometimes that is more helpful, because regardless of like, if you get a good therapist, that's great, but you still have to do the work yourself in your own head. You're like, you're the only person who can actually do the things that might help you cope better with what you have and retrain your brain and things like that. So you're not exactly on your own, but you are on your own to a certain extent, like when it comes down to it.
Yeah, no, which makes sense. So one thing that he comes up with is like, if his brain can make up rules for everything else, why can't he make up new ones for the OCD? Can you explain kind of what he means by that?
I can try. I suppose when you have OCD, your brain is kind of making up rules, basically. So it's saying, if you have this intrusive thought, if you do this certain thing, it'll make you feel better. And they're irrational, but you sort of train your brain by accident into thinking that's how you deal with it. So you do them over and over again, you get a little bit of temporary relief, the thought happens again, you do it again, and it just kind of goes around in circles. So to my mind, what he's talking about is basically deliberately trying to retrain his brain from those responses and those actions into something else, which he says in the interview is quite similar to exposure therapy, which is another really common treatment for OCD. They usually call it exposure and response prevention, which basically just means a situation in which you're deliberately exposing yourself to something that might trigger your OCD, and then trying to very deliberately and actively change what your response is to that. And it's really tough. You know, I've had a friend who had sort of germophobic OCD, who was going through this with a therapist. And one of the things was like, okay, go and sit on a public bench, which she really didn't want to do.
No one does.
And well, I don't mind. I don't have germophobic OCD.
There's chewing gum on them. A dog's walked on them at one stage. Yeah. Birds crap everywhere. I don't know if you're following this.
But that was the challenge. And it was really, really difficult, because it's for someone who is in that germophobic OCD mindset, that's a really, really difficult task to do. And it might just be go and sit on the bench for 2 minutes and then just see that nothing terrible happened as a consequence of that. And that's the sort of retraining your brain part. But I think there's another factor to this that I discussed with Wes. And so when he's talking about making new rules, sometimes instead of saying, I need to completely rid myself of this, you might just think that maybe that's not practical. So what can I do that's going to be a different rule or a different strategy that hasn't got me 100% away from OCD, but it's not wrecking my life?
Yeah.
So for me, for a while, I used to like video myself locking my front door. because then if I had the thought like, oh my God, what if I didn't do it? I could just get my phone out and look at the video. It's not perfect, but it stopped the previous action that was taken over.
Just my thought, my first process is, which is a completely different neurodiversity thing, is I'm just like, oh my God, all of her storage.
I did delete them.
Yeah, but eventually you didn't do it straight away. You had to keep it there for a little while.
Keep that till I got home, yeah.
I mean, one of the other things he talks about is sort of like not ending the compulsions, but sort of understanding the compulsions and living with them, which is what you're talking about with the door, right? Like it's still going to happen. And so it's not as if you understand what you have and it goes away, right? Like this is something that you have to deal with like all the time, and he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life, right?
Yeah, exactly. It is a lifelong thing that you'll have to varying degrees. So you can't cure yourself of it. And it's all about working with what you have available and understanding how your mind works so that you can try and change your responses and mean that it's not such a big problem in your life. And there's kind of a level of acceptance there as well. Mm. Kind of going through all the therapy acronyms now, but there's something called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is used in a lot of different ways. But one of the things they will get you to do is visualizing almost the thing that's upsetting you, the thing that's getting to you. And instead of thinking about it as directly in front of your face, it's thinking about it, it's in the corner of your eye. So it's still there, but you're trying to not stare it down, because, and it's that whole, as he says, don't think of a pink elephant thing, like immediately you're going to think of it. If you try and fight against those thoughts really, really hard, you're actually just making them bigger. So there is a level of accepting, this is how my brain works. These are the things that, I am anxious about, and I know that I will respond in a certain way. So how can I respond in maybe a healthier way, a way that doesn't affect me as badly?
Sorry, I am dealing with this cat who has his own issues at the moment, of which are undiagnosed. Maybe I'll put a TED talk on for him later. So once he starts to do this, he sort of moves back into professional cricket. I don't know if he wasn't offered a contract in Victoria, but Victoria had lots of quick bowlers at the time. But he goes back to South Australia where he sort of started his professional cricket journey anyway. And then he actually starts to be successful, right? Like that's the sort of big bash period that we know. He obviously ends up playing in domestic cricket around the world and all sorts of things. So clearly at this stage, he's on top of it a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. Or definitely coping with it in a better way. But I know that he said, you know, once he started getting successful again, it did sort of get heightened again because of that core fear being very connected to being a cricketer.
It's a really interesting thing, because that is when I remember him playing originally, you know, and obviously I'm one of the people who follows that sort of stuff. And I remember, and also because I remember his brother so well and had followed his brother's career. And so when he comes back and he becomes a better cricketer, he's obviously on a higher level. There's more pressure. He's eventually going to play for Australia, right? Like all these sort of things are happening. But he kind of, when he's in the game, it seems to be that actually is maybe one of the few times when he doesn't have the issues, right? Like it's weird being in a stadium with 25,000 people around you isn't heightening it the way that it might for many other mental health issues. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Yeah, Yeah, I thought that was one of the most interesting things, actually, because I think when I was thinking about it, my assumption would be that would be really difficult, especially because some of the other cricketers who've talked about having OCD have talked about it affecting their game and playing, like when they're in the game. But for Wes, he was saying that's sort of his sanctuary from all of that. It just isn't happening because he's focusing on what he's doing. You know, it just calms everything down. And when I heard that, I was surprised. But when I went away and thought about it, it did make sense to me, because if you think about OCD living in the realm of irrational and illogical, cricket has it is quite rational, it is quite logical. As I said in the piece, like, you know, if you're bowling, you're thinking about what ball you're going to bowl for a reason. There's a reason behind the choices that you're making. And especially these days when you've got so much data to back up basically any decision that you could make, there's so much information available to say why you would bowl that ball in that situation, or why you would play that shot in that situation. I can see how that would be really calming, because it's all these rational choices that have evidence for them. And that is sort of quite antithetical to OCD. Like when I'm at work and if I'm not having a great day, my best thing to do is sit down and do a spreadsheet job, because again, it's just all logical and rational. It's all just numbers that make sense. So I sort of comparing those two things, because to me, they operate in a very similar way.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard cricketers with other sorts of mental health issues sort of talk about it in the same way of when you're out on the field, you know what to do. That is your, you know, there is, you're almost like a tool at a certain point, right? Like, you know, my job is to bowl with a new ball and then at the death and patrol this boundary or whatever it may be, and, you know, as a fast bowler that you have to do. And when you get off the field, they sometimes just don't know how to handle general issues, because that there's too many variables, right? And so when you have a failure on the field, it isn't that it affects your on-field play, even if that's how we see it externally. It's actually that it affects them between the two games, and they can't get back to level. And it's really interesting that, like, that's something that Wes talks about, is, you know, when he gets home and the lights are out, where, you know, that's where he has his issues.
Yeah, that's probably the worst time for everybody, because, you know, you get home and turn the lights off and go to bed, and suddenly there's nothing else for your brain to process. So that's when you start churning over the stuff that's worrying you even more, which I think everybody does. So I think everyone can kind of relate to that concept of, oh, I've gone to bed and now all my worries are keeping me awake because I'm not being distracted from them.
And finally, lastly, like, the other thing is that he has decided to speak out about it. And we talked about this a little bit at the top, but I think people with OCD who have actually probably gone through the diagnosis, right? I can only assume this is true, but, like, I only recently got diagnosed with dyslexia. I can't even say it. That's how much I struggle with words. I only got diagnosed recently, and I already notice it when someone goes, oh, I'm a bit dyslexic. I'm like, shut up. That's
yes.
And so I can imagine if you have OCD, and he says that in your piece. I'm just trying to, I had the line, I've somehow accidentally deleted it, but he sort of says that people often go, oh yeah, I've got OCD a little bit, but he's trying to let people know that there is a real mental health thing, and it's not just like something that you say when you have, as you said, you check your door is locked once. Like, it's a thing that has had him. One of the stories in the piece is about him being unable to get out of a car and on a hot day in Melbourne, right? Like, and so he really wants people to know that this is a real thing, and also for other people to get help like he has.
Yeah, absolutely. I think both of us kind of wanted the same thing from it, really, which is to give people a bit more information about it, heightened awareness. But as you say, it's not just about, say, like, just knowing about it. Mm. It's people who might be affected by it, whether that's having it or whether they're supporting someone who has it, just that getting that more information. That's really bad English. Information about it's really helpful. It's definitely English. I think talking about representation, it's become a bit of a cliche sometimes. People just go, oh, representation matters, and then it's become a kind of corporate cliche. So it's companies going, oh, we've got a woman on our management board, so yeah, representation. But it does matter in this sense, I think, because there's not a lot of representations of people with OCD generally in the media or really anywhere. And if it is in the media, you know, it's either like, I don't know, someone who is basically some kind of savant who also has germophobia, like the detective show Monk, which I love, but it's
I mean, Monk's brilliant, you. But it's not. I can understand if you had OCD where you would look at Monk and just be like, oh, that's a bit annoying.
It's a good representation of OCD, but it's obviously not that many people who've got OCD who are also like brilliant savant detectives who can solve any murder just by looking around a room.
It's a bit like not all people who are autistic can be like Ben Affleck in the movie The Accountant. Like, it's not that the autism is shown poorly in that movie. It's just that it's still a superpower.
Yeah, it's a very small slice of what their experience is like. And then I think that's generally what representations of it tend to be like. And I guess if you're someone who thinks you might have it or you've been recently diagnosed with it and you'll start looking stuff up, I just think it's really important to have people from different walks of life who are doing different things to talk about it very openly and honestly, so you can see what that actually looks like, but also see that it's not necessarily going to be such a huge barrier to you in your life, or it doesn't have to be, even if you're not an incredible genius detective. You know, people can go on and do all sorts of things very successfully. But also being open about the struggle that involves.
I'm wondering now if the episode should be called The Incredible Genius Where They Go. But that's we'll bring that one back for later. This article really popped, and I know that the fanzine's been around for, 4 or 5 years, I want to say?
I think.
Is it more? It's been around for ages anyway. And you've had, obviously there have been articles that have popped before and, you know, times it's been in the news and all sorts of things. But this one, the sort of people who passed this around weren't the normal cricket Twitter people, right? Like I people were sending me this that were like, I don't even know how they found this article. And, you know, my betting group, it was popping around my betting group, which was like not where I expected to read about Wes Agar. Usually in our betting group, if Wes Agar is mentioned, it's why is he bowling this over? He shouldn't be. This is a bad matchup for him. So a very, you know, sort of different thing from there. What kind of feedback did you get from this? And were you surprised at how many people sort of read it and have shared it?
Yeah, it was all positive, which is good. I think when you're putting something out on this kind of topic, there was a little bit of anxiety that you might get some people saying unkind things, because it's always a possibility when you're talking about mental health or other things. But there was absolutely none of that. It's all been really positive and been really pleased with the reception that it's got. I know that both Wes and I have had some really nice messages about it. I've had some people just saying that they felt really grateful that he was so open about it and they could relate to it. And that was, you know, partly people who are cricket people, but it was also partly people who weren't, but because I'd shared it or the people had shared it, they'd still found that really useful. I had a nice message from a woman who's got a 10-year-old son who's got OCD who found it really helpful. And I think good to talk about with her son as well.
Yeah.
You know, if he's into sports, you say that here's someone who's really into sports, he's living with this and coping with it and being successful.
Yeah, I think, and it's one of those things as well, as we were talking about before, of that I think there's a lot of cricketers, and I don't just mean cricket, I mean a lot of athletes, but who have ADHD, and it is part of the reason they are successful, because that hyper focus and you know, and it can go the other way, of course, as well, and cause them issues in other aspects. But that one feels like it's been really representative, and depression is obviously being talked about a lot. OCD and anxiety and some of the others maybe haven't come up as much at the moment. So, you know, I think you saw the short video I did. I can tell you that, like, a big person in TV contacted me about the short video and was like, he wasn't even talking about the OCD. He was like, but his whole thing was, and this is what I really liked about your article, is the sort of people who are reading this would never read an article about OCD. Right? Like if there was just a normal article in The Guardian, they're just not interested in that. And you look at, you know, some of Donald McRae's work, and he, you know, he's very famous for this sort of stuff, but a lot of the sort of stuff that we're doing in cricket, and we didn't always cover this in cricket or in any sport, right? Like it was, that would have been seen as weakness and everything else. Whereas now you get to, you know, educate people like me and others in what OCD is, because we want to know about how it has affected Wes Agar's career. So sports writing at this level is really, really interesting. Is that why you want to write about these sorts of topics? Because it's a way to get it to people who wouldn't generally read about this sort of stuff.
Yeah, kind of. And I think it's just, obviously, I have a personal interest in it because it's something that affects me. So this specific one, you know, was a bit of my baby, because it's so relevant to my life. But yeah, in general, I think I'm interested in trying to find topics that aren't actually the sport, that exist within the sport, to write about, because a lot of the time it's not really about the sport, but it's a way in. And it's also a way of understanding, I think, athletes and the way that they play and the way that they behave and the sport itself a bit better too. A couple of years ago, my friend Jack wrote something for Daisy Cutter, which was about cricket being autism coded, which was great and went down really well. He's autistic, and I actually used to work with him at National Autistic Society. So, you know, he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And that went down well. And I think it was a really nice piece because it was about the crossover between cricket and the kind of experience of being autistic, but also how it's a really nice thing to be involved with when you're autistic, because it can really speak to a lot of the things that people find enjoyable or calming. But one of those things might be manual scoring. Like, that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
With people who are neurodivergent, they love to sit. I've got a colleague who said the same thing. He's autistic, and he was like, I just find it really calming to sit at a match and do some manual scoring. Same with my dad. Same with lots of people, really. And I just think there's a lot of interesting stories within any sport about all of these kind of things, if it's mental health conditions or I don't know, anything really. People's relationships with each other and how that's brought out in the sport is also something that I find really interesting to look at.
No, no doubt. Well, thank you very much for this article, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.